Yo and hello, you are, and welcome to Radio Free Roscoe. No, but I will always continue to reference that show because every time I'm on this mic, I'm not going to lie, that show comes into my mind, and it's because of the one mixed kid on there who looked like Corbin Blue but wasn't Corbin Blue. Anyway, this is a bizarro taro tangent. Yes, grab your bubble tea because we are entering into another episode of The Boom of Foolish. With me. Oh, I didn't even introduce myself. I'm your host, Jay. Hey, pronouns they, them. And I'm ready to get into the episode. So let's start. Myself a little bit of a week. Yes, I have been okay. Sorry, y'all. Should have put the phone not on ting 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 mode while I'm recording. So I have been going through a little bit of a growth process. I have like started the like official paperwork to get my business officiated by the province that I'm living in, get my tax situation set up with my GST and HST number. It's like, that's all that. There's a lot of stuff that I'm having to learn that I'm just like really upset was never even mentioned at any part of my public school education. Or was made a mandatory part of my undergrad. And I just think that that's such a missed opportunity to not give at least an intro to business. Because it just, if we think about it, right? And when you think about it, you're like, oh, this was intentional. This was intentional. Because, right, let me paint you the picture. Raised, grown, socialized within a capitalist society that tells you that your value is equal to the amount of effort and work that you are putting in, right? So you're just focusing on the work, on putting in effort, on just doing, without realizing that the capitalist system that you are one within and supporting, right, is dependent on your labor, on you being an agent of labor within the system and not someone who's in control of that agency, right? You're not actually someone who like is deciding what you do every day with your time and with your energy. But that's not the case if you're a business owner, right? All of a sudden, oh, now you have the freedom and the mobility to decide what you're doing with your day and your energy. But guess who has that information? Guess who gets supported? Guess who is the individuals, right, who are the keepers of how to be successful within this really very fucked up capitalist system, right? And it's those who have been doing business, right? And typically it's like the old white men. That's not to say that there aren't people who have found success through business, but I just mean like those who have really held on to the keys to success when it comes to like succeeding in a capitalist world. It's individuals who very much don't want you to be in charge of your own means of production, which now I understand also why socialism gets such a bad rap and gets so vilified, is because obviously if the masses were empowered to decide to do what they wanted to do with their own energy and were educated to know how to do so within a system that is incredibly limited, yeah, then of course the system, guess what, wouldn't work. So yeah, it's all starting to make sense to me, but it's just very frustrating that I'm like coming to this information from the outside in, kind of like, I feel like I'm looking through like cling film, like saran wrap that's just been like stuck to me for like a really hot day. And so I've like pulled it off of my like sweaty body and it's like kind of like crinkled and kind of like wet and I can't really see through it. I can kind of see it, but I can't really see through it, you know? Like, I get shapes. Like, I feel like that's where I'm at. Anyway, sorry for that imagery. Not sorry, but that's kind of where I'm at in terms of, like, the business and why is this, I'm even doing this, like, business stuff is because I've just been, like, taking on more projects, more workshops, more youth engagement activities, more seminars, more, like, online things. And I'm just like, girl, the government is going to fucking come for your throat. Like, they're going to not come in your throat, okay? That's not what I said. They're going to come for my throat. Yeah, they're going to try and, like, drag my trachea outside of my neck and just strip it onto the street because I haven't been paying taxes on the income that I've been getting. But I also don't feel like I should be paying taxes, like, reparations, you know? Like, at least don't let me make paper taxes. But I also do... Or maybe, like, let me choose. I wish I could choose. Like, if you're not going to give me reparations, at least give me, like, a list that I can tell you where to put my taxes. Like, I don't want certain things to be made with my money, and I don't want certain people to have my money. Sorry. I agree with taxes generally, but this idea that it's just like, oh, let me trust the government to redistribute this wealth wherever they see fit. No. No. Anyway, I've never had to even think like this. So, bizarro taro moment. Yes, grab the bubble tea. Every time I say taro, I just think of bubble tea. That's just my ADHD word association. And yeah, we're going to jump into, maybe I'll give you a little bit more tea about kind of what the week has been. Normally, I just like straight away talk about kind of like the animals and the Gagarandra. But I'm like, let me just like, you know, give you a little bit of a peek into the window. That is my life. So thankfully, also the heat wave that was murdering every... Okay, also... Wow, ADHD is really popping off today. The heat wave that was, like, ravishing the rest... I can't speak right now. Ravaging the West Coast saw, at least here in British Columbia, nearly, from the report I saw, it was over 400 people had passed due to heat-related medical conditions. And or strokes and or instances that resulted in death. And I think someone tweeted out something that I think was really well put, right? This idea that within months, people were able to mobilize, right, for this COVID-19 crisis because of the amount of deaths. But when you look at the climate crisis and you also look at the amount of deaths, like the rate, the speed, the quantity, it's all more shocking and alarming than COVID. And so it's all very sinister to me, like, just when you then compare our response to COVID versus when you compare our response to death related more so to climate change, right? Like heat waves and droughts and famines. Like, I think that we are really going to have to start, like, punching people in the throat who are holding the keys to the information that... is, like, I guess it's just being withheld to the public, right? And that's just, like, who currently is in power to be making decisions when it comes to big business, who is currently in power when it comes to, like, any sort of development around fossil fuels and what I would like to call, like, dirty energy, right? And so it's just, like, for me, there are so many different aspects of this that I'm just, like, oh. It's exhausting. And now, wow, I've just, sorry y'all, but it's like, I'm just now remembering also the TikTok where it's like, it was like a TikTok about a person with ADHD trying to get to the point. And it was, I felt so seen. It was just like, you say A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, and all you wanted to say was cat. Like, it's just like, all the wraparound. So I'm sorry. We're like a full on almost 10 minutes into the episode. You don't even know what the animal of the week is. And I still haven't even told you what I was doing this week. So I was teaching. I got paid to design and then facilitate a summer camp for Black youth here in Vancouver around urban ecology, wildlife more generally, and just trying to get them thinking about like the urban space and how they also connect to it. And so we actually just came back. I'm like recording this after coming back from like a little gathering where we were playing Frisbee and we were like at the beach. And I was like, oh my gosh, I love these kids. And then my body started doing this thing where I was like, oh, like, I feel like I don't, I feel like, I know I don't have ovaries, but I feel like I have like phantom ovary feeling sometimes. And yeah, when I'm around kids, especially, I get like these two little like poof, poof, like little stabs, like my gut being like, oh, don't you want some? And yes, I do. I really do. Every time everyone asks me, I'm like, yes, I want kids. Yes, I'm saying I want one because you always get one more than what you say. So I'm like saying I want one because I really want two. But if I say I want two, then I'll probably have three. You know how it works. Anyway, so I'm like, my ovaries are like, oh my gosh, in pain. Not actually, because I don't have ovaries. But I'm just like, I love kids. And I'm just like, then that got me feeling. I'm like, okay, I know that this feeling isn't exclusive to humans, which brings us into our animal of the week, which are gender role reversed aquatic animals. Yes, I mean, the ones that specifically in question here are the pipefish and the seahorse, which y'all know, but it's like, we're going to take a little second here to spill the tea, because the pipefish, right, is a small, it's kind of like a pencil-like fish. It has like a circular mouth, kind of resembles like a musical pipe. Gag. Sorry, my cat literally just jumped up onto the freaking recording area, Kida. Anyway, thank you, Kida. Where am I at? So yes, this is like, it kind of looks like a flute almost. So that's the pipefish. And the pipefish are cool because the male pipefish, they actually take the embryos from the female and they get glued to like their abdomen for some species. And then other, like, or not their abdomen, but kind of like the underside of this fish. And then that's where the like baby fish will then develop, like glued to these male pipefish. But then what's more interesting is that there's like actually another group of pipefish species that the males actually have like a protective like flap of skin, and that kind of like it partially covers the fertilized eggs. And ooh, that is like, that's the full moment. That's what I want. Just kidding, because actually what I do want is the seahorse fantasy. So y'all I hope if you're listening to the podcast that you've heard of a seahorse before. If you have never heard of a seahorse, they are like this mythical, magical creature that lives in the water. They say no to nature's typical expectations of, I mean, not even nature's, I'll just say humans' expectations of gender roles, being that women and femmes must bear the children and then reproduction because biology. Shh. Humans have children, period. Yes, some of those humans are women. Some of those humans are men. It's humans with wombs that can have children. And unfortunately, I am not one of them. But it's not about me. This is about the seahorse. Because they are actually related to pipefish species. Yeah, Gagaroni. Bet you weren't expecting that little phylogenetic moment. For those who don't know, phylogenetic is the term of the tree that we use when we're explaining evolution in science. It's like when you see images of like, oh my gosh, the whale was connected to the walrus, was connected to the fish, was connected to Tiktaalik. Like, that's the phylogenetic tree. Anyway, point being, a little bit of phylogenetics into this situationship. Seahorses related to pipefish. I'm not going to go deeper into that. That's all you get. One branch. Okay. This skin flap, though, gag, right, it developed into that elaborate pouch that actually fully closes. And as a result, the female will go implant her embryos in the male pouch, places these eggs in, and then the eggs actually get fertilized inside of that pouch, forming the full-blown children. And then the male becomes quote-unquote pregnant. I don't even know why I just said quote-unquote. The male is pregnant. By all definitions, by all means, the male is pregnant. And then you're like, but Jalen. But Jay. No, you didn't say but Jalen because you don't have permission to say my full name. So you said, but Jay. I thought you said, but they don't have a womb. So like, but what's happening? Oh my gosh, that's my cat again. And so, but what's happening? And I'm like, don't worry, girl. Don't worry. Not every animal needs a womb to be birthing children. So in the seahorse's case, right, because that pouch closes, they actually have very, I want to say, like, distinct, but I don't know why I'm throwing in words when I don't need to. They have control over the amount of oxygen that gets, like, passed over the surface area of the embryo. So it's actually really important, like, that the Papa Seahorse is doing work, capital W-E-R-K, because, like, mama, we said work, 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 like Rihanna, you got to balance the oxygen levels within your closed little sac. You also have to balance the salinity, making sure that it's not too salty in your crusty, dusty, looking like a musty crevasse. You know? We're thankful that seahorses were not white men in another life because they would not be showering. They would not be washing in between the pouch flaps. And these embryos would not make it. Just kidding. I don't know why that was uncalled for. But, but then again, so was slavery. Make yourself laugh. That's all that really matters. Okay, so you're balancing the salinity, you're balancing the oxygen, and then boop, boody, loop, boody, loop, time comes, and as a male seahorse, you get to birth not one, not two, but thousands of tiny seahorses, of little baby seahorselets. Absolutely love them. Anyway, as you can or cannot tell, seahorses and their adjacent distant cousin, the pipefish, they are our animals of the week. But we are now going to be swerving into 626. That's right. That's right. And for this week's 626, I thought I would... I mean, I'm not always weaving the thread of connectivity on this podcast. Sometimes there is, like, no connection at all from the animal of the week to 626. But there is this time because I had to do some more research. I had to do some more readings about seahorses. I was like, it can't just end here. Just because we are quote-unquote womb mates, like, that is a term I have invented, womb mates. It's when you don't have a womb, but there is someone or something, no, someone or some being that has a womb that you connect with, and that would be your womb mate. Kind of like a roommate, but you don't need to share the physical space. Yeah, it's more of like a metaphysical kind of thing. Anyway, so my womb mate being the seahorse, I'm like, okay, gag, work, we love to see you, but what is it about you? Like, what's actually the tea here? What's going on? And I then went down this huge rabbit hole of what is biological sex reversal, right? Like, what even is that conceptually? Because when we look at biologists, like, we know that they don't really have the best track record with being inclusive in the language that they use to describe these behaviors, to describe these instances, and describe these species that do fall outside of the binary that is typically pushed within the sciences, right? So that's first and foremost. We know that to be true. We know that history to be true. But then it's also like, There is still a lot of confusion around, well, how does sex reversal operate, and how can we actually define it? Like, is it something that is, like, consistent, like gravity that we can apply across all species, or do we have to have a species-specific approach for how we understand sex role reversal, right, behaviorally? So I wanted to take it back here and bring it to the point where it's just like, y'all, in biology, right, sex role reversal, first and foremost, let's just, like, define it. And that is, essentially, it occurs when the total parental investment by males in raising the young exceeds that of females, okay? So male seahorses and pipefish, they provide a great deal of parental investment, right, in terms of time spent rearing the young in their pouches or underneath their little skin flaps or glued to their abdomen, right?
But does this actually mean that they are a sex role reversed species? Do we know? Can we actually say that, right? Because simply having males provide some care for the young doesn't qualify as a sex role reversal, at least not to biologists, right? Just because Mark over here sometimes changes diapers and maybe will put the bottle in and maybe knows how to make macaroni and cheese and hot dogs, capital M-A-Y-B-E, that does not sex role reversal a species make. So, sorry, Mark, you're going to have to try a little bit harder, all right, if you're going to want to get the credit of being the parent, the main parent. And that's all that it is to it, right? When we're talking about biological sex role reversal, it's this recognition that there is a lot of species. Again, I don't want to say majority because majority actually has like statistical implications. Like when you say words have meanings, y'all. Semantics, like it's important. Like when we say majority, that means more than 50%, right? So I will be specific and be like a lot of species, right, typically have the females as the parental, as the individual who's investing the most in terms of parental behavior and energy. But that's not to say that there aren't countless individuals who break that mold, who defy it, and those who actually reverse it entirely. Not to mention that there are species that are not, they don't have this sort of monogamous two-gendered family setup. There are multi-gendered families. There are multi-gendered polyamorous relationships as well. And so looking at things like the sunfish, which is like a multi-gendered family and polyamorous, is like, we'll go into that a little bit in the next episode. But I was like, okay, for 626 this week, let's find a paper. Let's actually look for a research paper that talks about the sex role reversal of pipefishes and seahorses. So this week's paper was published in the Trends in Ecology and Evolution Journal. And it was written by Amanda Vincent, Ingrid Anesjo, Anders Berglund, and Gunilla Rosevenquist. And the paper is titled Pipefishes and Seahorses. Are they all sex role reversed? And the abstract, which I actually really enjoyed, I'm going to read that for y'all now so you can have like a little ooh-ah-ah moment with me. So the male pregnancy of pipefishes and seahorses has led to the influence. Oh, nope, that's not the word there. Not me trying to read something for y'all. Can't read. So, starting again. The male pregnancy of pipefishes and seahorses has led to the inference that females compete most intensely for access to mates, because males limit female reproduction. However, okay, well, let's hold up. Let's kind of unpack so far where we are in the abstract. So they've said, they're essentially saying, right, that the pregnancy, the fact that males, pipefishes and seahorses get pregnant, has led a lot of scientists to make this claim, right, that females are actually the ones competing for males. Females are in high competition. They're like, oh, I'm gonna try and fight you. I'm gonna try and secure my man. I'm gonna try to do this because males are the limiting factor when it comes to making sure that the next generation even happens. So if you are a female, you're like, oh shit, okay, I want to make sure that there's like, you know, generations to come after me. You are trying to snag down your man, zizziz, so you can then impregnate your man, zizziz, so he can carry your children for you, right? So in that setup, right, it's led to a lot of scientists to believe that this sort of competition amongst females is because males are a limiting factor in reproduction. However, okay, this is where it continues the abstract. However, recent work has shown that in different species, either sex may be the predominant competitor for mates. So in this family, there is an apparent association, right, between the mating pattern and the sex roles. So polygamous species show reverse sex roles, whereas monogamous species exhibit conventional sex roles. So these studies emphasize that the sex role reversal is not synonymous with male parental care, but rather with love style of the species itself. Mm-hmm. And that, as someone who's a pans, polyamorous, thotty ass, hoe, I fucks with that. I vibes with that on a deep level. This idea that you not only fucks with gender, but your ability to fucks with gender is a direct tie of your polyamorous, polygamous setup, politic, attitudes, opinions, beliefs. I love that. I love that. The freedom that is awarded outside of this binary because of your desire to be a hoe and sleep with a lot of people and or be in relationship with a lot of people or beings. And I love that. And I absolutely love that. So that's the abstract. If I'm being honest, y'all, like I don't want to give y'all too much. The paper is kind of thick in like jargon. We're talking like 3 C's. We're talking like, oof, we're talking heavy. The paper's cute. Like, it's a good paper. But I just wanted to more so like read the abstract with y'all today and just show you that like when you do have a question or you do have like a moment that you want to like, you know, connect with wildlife, connect with research paper, connect with like anything really, like you have to go out of your way to continue to do that research first and foremost. And secondly, like it's going to be worth it because once you find that paper, it's going to be incredibly affirming. And that's just where we are now. I'm just like, oh, it's giving me life. Sorry for your ears, but I actually was like, I was like just signing off of the 626 segment. I was like, not even a little bit, not even a little, you're not even gonna read to them a little bit. So I'm like, okay, I will. You got me. Let's go to the discussion. Also, this is the thing too. This paper is not available to the public. Like, it was really hard to access. So I've downloaded it and I'm going to see if I can actually share the PDF file in the show notes for the extra content for this episode over on the Patreon. So if you would like to read the paper, you can head on over to patreon.com/JohnTinkJ. But otherwise, this will be your little moment. So in the discussion, right, it actually goes on to talk about how the competitive behaviors will, or at least selection for competitive behaviors, actually operates more strongly on males than it does on females. And it in this one little section here, so this is on page 3, and it reads, the more intense male competition for mates may at least partially derive from the strongly male-biased operational sex ratio amongst unpaired seahorses. So equal number of reproductive males and females have been found in all wild seahorse populations examined so far in the study. But laboratory studies of H. fusca species indicate that non-pregnant males have shorter preparatory periods, which is just a fancy way of saying before being ready to mate, like the period before they're ready to mate. And they also have longer receptive periods. So periods when they're ready and able to mate with other females. And that these males, right, they also actually have shorter refractory periods, right? So that's just the period of time after failing to mate. So, and all of these metrics that they were measuring around the males, they were all greater than unmated females, right? So if in theory, right, if this was actually being compared with females and competition was higher amongst females, then you would see unmated females actually scoring higher in all three of these metrics, right? In longer receptive periods, in shorter refractory periods, right? But that's not the T, it's males. And so what's the T here? It seems, right, that they say, what do they actually say? Not me trying to interpolate live action. It says, the selection to develop competitive behaviors is stronger on males than on females. So we love that. Even though it would, like logically to me, it would make sense that competition is acting more strongly on female behavior, but that's not the case, at least what they were able to find within the reproductive female seahorses from the laboratory population. And that's something, too, that the paper does bring up, but there's something I kind of want to touch on, too, is, like, this idea in science, right, is that we can get really good data from conducting ethical and really well-planned out and really well-considered research experiments. However, right, when we look at the applicability of our data from these ex situ experiments, which ex situ just means like outside of the site or outside of nature. So when we look at these laboratory experiments, right, it's like, can we make confident inferences, right, decisions about this data if it's not reflective of what's actually happening in a more natural setting, in a more naturalized world? And that's what it's just like a little bit of a touch on, because that's something for me that really hits home as someone who does a lot of urban ecology work, especially with urban raccoons and hopefully in the future urban skunks and urban coyotes, right? It's this idea that within lab settings, we can recreate essentially any condition we want. But setting up cognitive experiments within a natural urban space, there are so many other factors to consider. There are so many other compounding variables to consider that could influence not only the participant's willingness to engage in your experiment, but the outcomes of that experiment first and foremost. So kudos to these scientists for not only like going out there in the name of queer ecology, but like studying a species that isn't easy to study or like easy to access. Like you had to attach scuba gear. You had to go underwater. You had to spend multiple hours across multiple days, across multiple weeks collecting this data, all in the name of seahorses and pipefish. And I am very thankful. So again, if this little 626 moment got your girlies in a bunch, then head on over to the Patreon. But otherwise, let's just jump straight into what's the sitch, because we got a doozy this week.
So what's the sitch?
This week's conflict. I don't know why I tried to sing after Kim Possible. I mean, that wasn't Kim Possible. What are you talking about? Copyright? Who? I don't know why I attempted to sing after a nameless, redheaded, cheerleading superhero from the early 2000s. But I do know that I have such internal conflict when I even talk about the topic that I'm going to be bringing y'all today's ears. So this topic is one that is dear and near to me, one that I'm going to be trying to like unpack over the next couple episodes. And it's this idea, right? What happens when conservation efforts are successful, right? And it's like, and what do I mean by that? Because I'm not like, okay, what happens when we can, like, when we restore the population of the forested newt? Like, no, I'm talking about, like, what we as a very speciesist global north perpetuate in terms of, like, who we want to see saved, who we want to give conservation areas to, where we want to design and put up new national parks and wildlife protection areas, right? And for the most part, it is individuals in the global north, right, in the quote unquote, I forgot, I said earlier, I said this in like season one, so you can go back and listen to it in season one. I don't like saying the global, like, I don't like saying developed countries. I actually like saying, like, the global north is undeveloped when we look at how far we have to go socially and just, like, as a society to rectify all of the fuckery that our part of the world has perpetuated and resulting in inequality for others. So I'm like, yeah, we're not really developed. We have a long way to go. That being said, developed in terms of, like, the colloquialism, which is that typically like the quote-unquote G20 countries, those that have taken natural resources away from underdeveloped, quote unquote, countries, typically being in on the African continent or on the South American continent, or within Asia, having those resources extracted, using those resources to build up their own economies, their own societies, and their own infrastructure, and then claiming that, you know, everyone has equal responsibility for climate change. No, no. Anyway, so my gag is that, like, we as a global north be pushing agendas all the time. Save the rhinos, save the cheetahs, save the lions, save the zebras, save the charismatic megafauna. Anna. Because that's all, as a global north, is marketed, is what is really easy to capitalize when you look at our economic structure here in the global north, right? This idea that everything has to be turned into a profit, and that includes conservation and climate action. And so how do you turn that into a profit? Well, you make it so that only the animals that are the cutest, the cuddliest, right? The ones that take good photos are the ones that you get people to care about. Then that creates disproportionate amounts of funding, amounts of data, amounts of scientific research being conducted. And as a result, you can create very unique conflicts like the one we're going to be talking about today, which is this idea that happens when coexistence is forced before the human society is ready for it. So what do I mean by that? Is we have a lot of places around the world where people from the global north go to perform conservation work in the name of a charismatic megafauna. So that could be for a cheetah, that could be for a tiger, that could be for an elephant, what, right? And so my question is, and the conflict I want to bring us to attention is this very interesting one, right? It's this idea that what happens when these animals start bouncing back? What happens when the populations, right, from these conservation efforts actually are able to rebound and they actually increase in some cases? So what then is the situation that we're leaving for human residents that not only are dependent on these shared sort of periphery spaces, right? The spaces that border these national parks, these conservation sites, these like more ruralized, more naturalized habitats, right? What do we say to those communities? And also the communities that depend on the farming production and the crop production that takes place along the periphery communities. So I'm going to say community A, right, are the communities that are around national parks, right? And then community B are more like people like you and me who are more distant away from these naturalized areas. You're more in manufactured landscapes. And so you are reliant on individuals who reside and live in more rural, more naturalized landscapes to produce goods like food for you. So community A, the one living closer to these national parks, well, we're putting them in a direct position of conflict, right? We are saying that your safety as a community isn't as important as the overall population dynamics and characteristics and well-being of this insert charismatic megafauna species here. So that could be in the case, right, that we're going to be talking about today in Bandipore National Park. That could be an increase in tigers, in leopards, right? Actually, then putting humans at a disproportionate risk for conflict, right? And that's because conservation was the main thing that was focused, as opposed to, right, a more ground up, more grass fed, more community based a solution that actually is rooted, right, in coexistence, because you need the safety of the humans surrounding and stewarding and caring for these naturalized spaces that then end up sharing space with these species that then get brought back or bounced back, right? So let's look at, for example, tigers, elephants, and leopards. These three species are ones that have a lot of conservation efforts, dollars, time, energy, research teams focused towards them. And not a lot, I mean, granted, you, like, we're still in a capitalist world, typically, that is intent on resource extracting and destroying. So not as like, oh my gosh, everyone's out here working with leopards, tigers, and elephants, but in terms of like the total amount of people working with conservation work, disproportionately, a lot of them are with these charismatic megafauna. And so you have the situation, right, that then happens that you're seeing, like, in Bandipora National Park and Narghahol National Park, which are both in Karnataka, and that's in India. And I'll go ahead and link all of this, you know, extra content over for y'all on the Patreon. But essentially, it's the situation that we're seeing happening in these two national parks where we're experiencing about 9 human-animal conflicts per day on average in these park spaces as a result of the success of these conservation efforts for these species, right? And so it's this really interesting type of conflict. Not interesting, because, I mean, conflict, I think it's always so weird when people who aren't, like, affected by something use the word, like, interesting or cool. Like, it's not. It's, like, it's scary and it's drastic, but it's, like, I'm, as a trauma response and as a coping mechanism, I often, like, will belittle something as a way to not give it all of the energy that it needs so that I don't get too overwhelmed. But it is kind of overwhelming when you look at this sheer number, 9 human animal conflicts per day, right? For a community that is, I mean, for community A isn't just one community in this metaphor. It's like built up of several communities that border around these national parks and these naturalized spaces, right? And when we look at the impacts to community A's, it's like these communities aren't that big. They don't have many people. And so 9 a day? What's 9 times 365? Quick, get your phones out. I'm not doing it. That's a lot of conflicts within a year to experience as a small community, right? And so when we look at that, it's like, well, then who is the brunt of that risk actually equitable, right? Because so often, so quick, eco-fascists will jump to be like, well, I don't care about humans, and humans are, well, we're the plague on the planet. I'm like, okay, tell me you're a white supremacist in an environmental vest without telling me you're a white supremacist in an environmental vest. Because this idea, right, that like, oh, humans don't matter, oh, humans don't know all this damage, blah, 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 blah. It actually is rooted in white supremacy. Because when you look at the humans who are most impacted and most affected by these types of wildlife conflicts, by these nuanced types of, and very novel, I should say, not nuanced, but it's both, but novel type of human-wildlife conflicts, it's disproportionately Black and brown people and indigenous people to these countries, right? It's disproportionately not felt by white, wealthy individuals, also, quote unquote, who happen to just also be the demographic who own the majority of successful resource extraction companies. So do we see the connections? Do we see how it's actually not a cute moment for people to be like, oh my gosh, well, I don't care about humans. Humans need to take the brunt of it. Because when you actually apply critical race theory to what it is that you're saying, bam, the white supremacy done jumped out of you. So be critical. And when you're saying, yes, I agree vaguely in the sense that like human priorities as a general whole should not be held above any other species on this planet, but you cannot move through this world without compassion, and you cannot expect solutions to be developed if you don't root them in the communities and the individual experiences of the people that are most impacted by them, right? And so it's like, oh, there's so many facets here that I'm trying to get at, and I'm hoping that this is making sense into your ears, but it's just like, it's very frustrating for me because it's like, this is an aspect of my career field, I guess you could say, or of the environmental sphere more generally, that is perpetuated by problematic ideologies that we have here in the global north, right? It's perpetuated, right, by speciesism. It's perpetuated by white supremacy. It's perpetuated by white saviorism. It's perpetuated, right, by these ideas that we hold about who deserves saving, protection, and funding around those notions, and who does not. And I think that that creates then these complex situations where we have 9 human-animal conflicts per day on average in these communities. But then we're looking at that,
right? And let's expand that out. Let's actually take this out and look at the full breadth of this conflict. And when we expand it out, we begin to see, well, okay, 9 individuals who are hurt but on average every day, those injuries aren't going to look the same. They're going to be different depending on the species. A human-wildlife interaction with an elephant versus a tiger versus a leopard, right? The potential for death is going to be very different for each of those species. It's still really high for each of them, but it's still going to be very different for each of them, especially depending on the time of day, depending on who you're with, where you are, all of these factors, right? And when we look at the situation, when we look at the story, it's actually really, really sinister, right? Because then it actually becomes even more complex, even more rooted in white supremacy and actually classist fucking inequality, because it's not only these communities that are being directly harmed as a result of successful conservation, but these are then the communities that are responsible for crop production, right? These are the communities that are responsible then for also safeguarding these natural spaces, for making sure people who shouldn't be there don't enter, for also stewarding the land, be that protecting the water, protecting the actual soil, protecting the actual forest elements, harvesting the land, right? When we look at the individuals who are actually in relationship with the land and are now being disproportionately negatively impacted as a result of external conservation efforts, and how those are then all of that is then directly limiting their ability to produce goods for themselves and their own communities, right? But then we know, because of the way that global inequality and capitalist fucking markets work, that for you as a community, you'll prioritize producing to get to market, right? To get your products, be it your crops, be it your forest goods, be it whatever it is that you're harvesting from the forest or producing in proximity to it, you're trying to use that to produce an income, to secure your own safety, your own medical needs, your own financial needs, right? That is the system that you are in. So then imagine now not only having your means of production limited as a result of these very unequal conservation success stories, but then also y'all then get doubled down on the negative impacts, because then you don't have things to take to market, and people like me and like listeners of this podcast who aren't living in these naturalized, more rural communities closer to these national parks and to these conservation sites, right? When we then are like, oh, work, okay, well, we're not going to buy this, or we're not going to buy that, maybe I'll just get imported goods. Like, it's all connected, right? And it's so unfucking fair. It's so unfair that even in success stories for conservation, the white supremacy, the classism, the inequality of it all still jumps out and disproportionately affects members of my community. That really took me out, y'all. When I came across this topic for the conflict today, I was like, that's a doozy. That is a doozy. So the research that I was doing for this topic was, it came from Bandipora National Park and Nargahole National Park. As I said, that was in Karnataka. And it came from records of 10,000 instances of human-animal conflict from data that was collected during the Wild Seas program. And that was put on by the Wildlife Conservation Society, or WCS. They're an international wildlife nonprofit. I'll go ahead and share all that extra goody goods in the show notes for today's episode. But I really want y'all to think critically about even success stories that you're hearing, right? Even not just success stories. No, we need to start being way more critical about everything that we are being told, right? All the feel-good stories, all the success stories, what have you. We need to always be aware that there will always be someone, probably a Black or a Brown person, predominantly an Indigenous person, right, that will have suffered to see that success. So
again, this isn't to say, oh, well, we should stop conservation then in the sake of humans. No, I'm not saying that, but I'm saying that in terms of the type of conservation that we support, that we fund, that we hold space for in as a society, right? I think it really needs to be reflected upon, reconsidered. And that actually brings us swiftly into this week's show sponsor. Yes, who does just that. So our show sponsor this week is, as you guessed it, the one and only Martin Bunzel. Yes, who is the author of Thinking While Walking, a book about, or I say book, it's a book. It's kind of like a collection of thoughts. I would say it's like a journal. It's like a published journal, but it's a book. It's classified as a book. And it's about reflections along his journey from the on the Pacific Crest Trail. Martin Bunzel, he's a philosopher, and the book highlights both the beauty of nature and his examinations throughout a series of thought-provoking questions that he developed around his respect for nature and for natural selection, right? These include musings around the difference and distinctions between our opinions of trees and the beetles that affect them, animal rights, and broadening that even more so to vegetation and the rights that we award nature and natural spaces. And also in his book, thinking about and pushing the conversation, right, about the distinction between what even is natural and quote unquote manufactured. So if that sounds like your cup of tea, girl, head on over Amazon, get that ebook edition, only $5, or you can get the paperback, $9.99, either or. It's available wherever you buy books. I'll drop the link over on the show notes and the Patreon, but big ups to this week's show sponsor. It is people like you that make the continuation of this podcast possible. It does take time, y'all, to get the research ready, to get the extra content ready, and I don't get paid to do this. Like, this is my first sponsor opportunity. And so, yeah, being able to like take that and then being able to dedicate more of my time, I really appreciate that. So if you're interested in being a sponsor, or if you're interested in supporting the podcast and you just want to like show that love, show that support, engage, head on over to Patreon. That's patreon.com/JohnTeamJ. As always, there's a load of free content for you available over on the IG and on Twitter. That's at JohnTeamJ. And that's been this week's episode of Zabuma Foolish. Thank y'all for listening. Your little moment about gendered roles within the animal world. And we'll touch base. We'll touch base next week. Maybe about animals that play with gender. Hint, hint. We're going to be talking about drag. Okay, but we'll do that next week. Which also, by the way, has anyone watching Drag Race All Stars, because that is becoming wild. Also, another thing. Oh my goodness. Actually, great, great. We're going to end the episode on this point. Do not send me a DM asking me what I think about RuPaul and his damage to the environment and his stance on fracking and all the yada yada. If you can't, in the same sentence, name a single white person that has invested in fracking, period. Period. Don't come into my DMs. Don't come into my inbox. If you want to have the conversation about fracking and investors, sure, we can. But don't cherry pick the only black and queer investor into a problematic industry that you know of and use them as the scapegoat or the figurehead of the problematic fossil fuel industry. Yes, fossil fuels are problematic. Yes, investing in them is also problematic. Do a disproportionate amount of white people and white men specifically invest in fossil fuels? Yes. Do they do anything for the queer community, let alone create multiple drag showcase television programs on multiple continents? No, they don't. So I will not have that conversation with you ever, but especially if you can't even name a single white investor. Because to me, then it just goes to show me that you're just anti-black. That's it. Sorry, I don't make the rules. Actually, I do on this podcast. That's one of them. Okay, bye! Catch y'all next week. Yay.